Please note that the opinions and perspectives shared on the Real Pharma podcast by Nari O and Ian Wendt are their own. These views do not represent the positions, strategies, or opinions of their employers or any other organizations with which they may be affiliated. Now on with the show.
So, you know, we start seeing a lot of interest in combining immunotherapy with radiopharmaceuticals, where you target the tumor in different ways. There's a lot of things that can be add benefit to the patient by combining different modalities. The challenge with that, then you're adding costs to the healthcare system. So how do you contend with that? And how do you make it easy for the patients to receive different treatment options in a very short period of time?
This is Real Pharma, your podcast for real conversations with pharma pathfinders. In every episode, you will hear from an industry insider who has a story to share that goes beyond the headlines. No spin, no sacred cows, no hidden agendas, just stories and the people behind them. Now, here are your hosts, Dr. Nari O and Ian Wendt.
Welcome back. Roger Estafanos is a recognized leader in the biopharmaceutical industry, known for his expertise in driving innovation and transforming patient care. With a robust background in strategic development, commercialization, and clinical development and regulatory affairs, Roger has contributed to advancing cutting-edge therapies from concept to market. Roger has also played a pivotal role in the field of radiopharmaceuticals, an area of biopharma focused on developing diagnostic and therapeutic agents that use radioactive isotopes to target cancer with precision. With extensive experience in this emerging sector, Roger has been instrumental in advancing novel radiopharmaceutical treatments, especially for oncology and rare diseases. His work includes guiding these specialized products through development and commercialization and pioneering collaborations to expand patient access. His insights on the impact and future of radiopharmaceuticals are invaluable for understanding how these innovations are reshaping personalized medicine. Welcome, Roger.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Welcome to the show, Roger. We're so excited to have you. And before we dive into this topic of radiopharmaceuticals and what it means, I just wanted to start with a few numbers. I looked up some of the deals that happened this year in this area. And so we have AstraZeneca that acquired Fusion Pharmaceuticals for $2.4 billion. Novartis acquired Mariana Oncology for $1 billion plus additional milestones. And then BMS acquired RayzeBio for $4.1 billion, all in the field of radiopharmaceuticals. So can you start with just explaining what is this? What does radiopharmaceuticals mean? What's their role in modern medicine? And how are they impacting and transforming patient care?
Sure. Thanks for having me here. So radiopharmaceutical, it has been very busy space recently. To start off, radiopharmaceutical has been around actually for a very long time. Even before Marie Curie, who pioneered the radioactivity research in the early 1900s, eventually radiopharmaceuticals was used in different variety of application, imaging, treating cancer, for example, thyroid cancer treatment, I-131. FDG imaging in many cancer types, and that evolved over the decades. So to simply describe the current radiopharmaceutical structure of the molecule, is if you think about it, it's in the three components. You have the targeting molecule that can be a peptide or a protein that targets a cell, cancer cells, and then you have the linker that connects this targeting molecule with a radioactive payload, and that radioactive payload being that third component. Can be imaging or therapeutic isotope. And that can be used as in different application, imaging and therapy. And that typically sits in a cage. So think of the three components and this concept creating the theragnostic concept. A theragnostic is it's a kind of made up word that combines diagnostic and therapy. And that's essentially what has been the core application of radiopharmaceuticals more recently. We like to say in that space, if you see it, if you see what you treat, treat what you see. And it's basically the application of diagnostic radiopharmaceuticals to show where the tumors are, the metastases, then leading that to the therapy and how to treat the patients, hence see what you treat, treat what you see. And that has been transforming the patient care over the last 10 years or so, more recently. And in 2018, Lutathera was approved. I think that was the biggest splash in the market. Before that, it has not been gaining any traction. And since then, even though Lutathera was in a rare disease, I think it made a huge impact on the patient care. And then a couple of years ago, Pluvicto in the prostate cancer was approved. And that, again, kind of just put it on the main stage, if you will, because obviously prostate cancer being a very prevalent disease, it's the second leading cause of death in men. Obviously, that showed a lot of interest, just a lot of impact on patients. So radiopharmaceuticals, and there's a lot more to come as well. So that's, I think what we're seeing is just the beginning of a new treatment modality that will be around hopefully for a long time.
And the two examples you mentioned, you know, you kind of said that really transform patient care, but can you be more specific? And how was this a big improvement over previous treatments or standards of care? Was it more in the efficacy or safety tolerability, or what was different about the outcomes with these particular interventions?
What's so great about radiopharmaceuticals in general is the targeted nature of the treatment. So the mechanism of action, as I described, the molecular structure lends itself for a very targeted approach. It goes directly to a tumor, delivers the radioactivity directly to the tumor instead of having systemic radiation or overburdening the body with a lot of chemotherapy. It goes directly to where it needs to be treated. And that helps, obviously, with minimizing side effects as far as the overall patient quality of life as well. That also helps with the ability to impact patient benefit. And that has a lot of tremendous impact on how the patients see this and how they interact with it. Physicians also see this as a way of impacting patients and treating patients with a therapy that will reset the clock, if you will, because it's very directed therapy. Then, you know, blast, as I said, they're blasting the patient with a lot of chemotherapy.
So I think what's fascinating about radiopharmaceuticals is, first of all, what you mentioned is very targeted. And the two tumor types that you mentioned obviously are very small and very small organs or parts of the body. So you don't want that huge effect that impacts the surrounding tissue. So that's very appealing. And then the second is, you mentioned that you can do both diagnostics and therapeutics, where you have both applications. And I think that's a little bit different as well, right, Roger?
Yes. So what's so unique about it is you can have a complementary imaging tool. So, for example, with lutetium, you have gallium, and they both attach to a similar molecular structure that can give you that. Also, what's also very interesting is that actual therapy can be imaged with a SPECT imaging. So you can actually see how the biodistribution happening almost in real time. So you have the patient that was just received a lutetium therapy. You can put the patient on a SPECT camera, and you can see what was the absorption of the tumor and to what extent that potentially can correlate, hopefully, that with efficacy and obviously more of a response to the therapy. So that's a very unique aspect to the to that type of treatment.
And then before we go into some of the details, can we start with something more basic? I've read different description or different terms, like radioisotopes, radioligands, radioconjugates, radiopharmaceutical therapeutics. Can you go through that a little bit more? Is this all the same thing? Or, you know, are they some more towards the diagnostic aspect and others more towards the therapeutic aspect?
So what you're referring to, all these terms refer to one thing of some sort, because I think people kind of informally refer to it, but they're actually a lot of different things. So you have the radioisotope, that's the actual isotope that goes into the therapy or the diagnostic. The radioligand, the ligand is a way of targeting the tumor, attaching it to the molecular structure so that would be targeted. So, for example, PSMA, it's some sort of a ligand where, for example, you have a somatostatin receptor that attached to a peptide. So there's a lot of different ways to look at it. So kind of going back and trying to describe some of this terminology, sometimes it's referred to radiopharmaceuticals, also referred to as radioligand therapy. The isotope goes into making up the payload. It's kind of lend itself to the mechanism of action.
Yeah, and I think I understand, why this is considered very targeted therapy and all the benefits might go along with that. Should we think about this as personalized medicine? I mean, are these engineered for a specific patient and their tumor, or is this more kind of off the shelf, for lack of a better way of saying it, in terms of having application across all patients with specific tumor type?
So where we are right now is typically it's a standard dose for all patients. The absorption of the dose can vary from patient to patient depending on a lot of factors. So it's part of the precision medicine. It's very personalized medicine because the medicine is made for the patient. I can see in the future where there would be a lot of personalization in that based on a predictable algorithm where you can predict the absorption based on, for example, the imaging, and eventually you can make a specific dose for a specific patient based on a lot of factors, whether if it's the absorption, based on weight, based on the burden of the tumor, based on the function of critical organs, whether if it's the kidney or the liver. So there's a lot of factors that eventually I think we'll get into. I'd like to say that, what we have so far is the onset of radiopharmaceuticals 1.0. And I think there is going to be a lot more to come. Obviously, there are a lot of targets being explored right now in a lot of pipelines. You mentioned some deals that happened over the last couple of years. But there's also a lot of investment in different disease areas outside of, what I mentioned earlier. So now they have glioblastoma, ovarian cancer, small cell lung cancer, just to name a couple. And there's a lot more to come.
And then, Roger, you also mentioned there are different radioisotopes. So, for instance, Pluvicto, Lutathera, they're lutetium-based, and there's actinium. How can we understand what radioisotopes are applied where? Is it based on the tumor type? Is it based on diagnostics versus therapeutics? How can we understand that better?
So when you think about the isotope, think of the physics of the isotope itself. So for example, lutetium, it's a beta emitter, and it tends to target the tumor and break the DNA of the cell in a certain way because of the length of how much they travel. On the other hand, actinium-225, it's an alpha emitter. It targets the double strand DNA. And it has smaller travel distance. So every isotope has a characteristics and profile of how they target. There is also other novel isotopes. For example, lead-212 is another. It's alpha. And there's a lot more that's being explored in different type of development.
From a regulatory and approval pathway perspective, are there major differences between, let's say, a traditional pharmaceutical and radiopharmaceutical in terms of time or kind of the regulatory environment? What are the major differences that might exist there?
So outside of the mechanism of action, as you can imagine, there are a lot of differences between radiopharmaceutical and traditional pharmaceutical regulatory framework or process. I think one of the things that's really different in radiopharmaceutical is how you look at toxicity. So for example, In chemotherapy, you're trying to find a threshold. What is the toxic dose? And then basically you want to just stay at the threshold. Whereas in radiopharmaceutical, you go about it in a different way because this is radiation. So you look at how much critical organs like the liver and kidney can take in terms of radiation. And obviously you don't want to go near the toxic side of things. And there are different benchmarks right now because we're still in the phase of trying to develop frameworks and data as an industry and also the regulatory body. We use the standards in radiation oncology, which is the 23 gray absorption in the kidney as a standard for the threshold starting from there. And I think that's going to change over time as the FDA and the industry and academia learn to work together and developing more structure around that. That's actually one of the key differences. The other thing that I think would be interesting to share is Iridium pharmaceuticals tend to be an open label just because you can't have double-blinded data, the double-blinded trial. It makes it very difficult. So you have that going in, and you have to factor in making sure that your clinical trial is designed properly with the inclusion of an open label. Kind of stepping away from the regulatory, but it has an impact on clinical trial is patient access. Typically, you know, when you have an oncologist, they tend to think of enrolling patients in a traditional product clinical for trials. They don't think of radiopharmaceuticals as a go-to. So getting the word out and educating patients and educating oncologists is very important to make sure that helps with the recruitment, to make sure that we have access to different patients, different types of patients, to make sure that they're included in the profile that's eventually shared with the regulatory bodies.
So another aspect of that, I imagine, is how do you safely handle and administer radiopharmaceuticals? So it's still a somewhat new field. And you just mentioned even oncologists may not be as familiar with it. They tend to have a short half-life. And so there are new challenges that we have to consider in this area. Is that something that you think is also still evolving? Are there standards? I mean, what's your perspective on that safety aspect?
So that's definitely an evolving part of the industry. So based on the ISTO, you have a different half-life. So for example, lutetium is 6.7 days half-life. And that obviously impacts the handling, the shipping, and the logistics of it. You have other products that other isotopes that may have longer or shorter half-life. So for example, if you compare it with lead 212, it has a much shorter half-life. So that changes how you handle it and how fast you need to get it to the patient. So you have the just-in-time manufacturing, which has a huge impact. So, you know, for example, you can't obviously make the doses and put them on the shelf waiting for the patients, whether if it's clinical trial or commercial. You can't shelf it. You can't stock it in a warehouse. So everything is done essentially on demand, just in time. And the actual delivery process, you're racing against time. I like to use the metaphor, the example of you're basically delivering melting ice, and you're racing against time to make sure that that dose with a viable strength reaching the patients on time, and it's also administered properly. So there's a lot of aspect to that as well. And then on the administration side or the treatment side, you need to have the right infrastructure. You need to have people who are trained, able to interact with the patients, educate the patients. You haven't have the specific licensing necessary for administering radioactive material. You have to have an authorized user. Usually it's a nuclear medicine physician or radiation oncologist. They're trained and they're licensed to administer these therapies. Also, you have to have a way of getting the oncologist and the administering physician work together hand in hand to treat the patient. That's true, whether if it's a clinical trial or a commercial product available for all patients.
So, Roger, is it fair to say then that right now access to radiopharmaceuticals is somewhat limited by the infrastructural challenges? Because I assume that there are not that many places that can really go through this process in a sustainable way and on a large scale.
So there's also another evolving aspect of the industry or this area. Initially, you would start seeing it in academic institutions and large hospital systems. They tend to have the infrastructure and the staff to handle the complexity of this therapy. But now you start seeing these type of therapies leaving academic centers and making their way to the community. So you start seeing oncology practices, for example, that they have a radiation oncology infrastructure adopting this therapy because it's very much easier to adopt for them rather than they adopting it de novo. Also, what's really interesting in this space, over the last 3 to 5 years, we start seeing a dedicated theranostic centers only for that type of therapy. Whether if it's therapy or diagnostic, they're dedicated to help to deliver imaging and therapy radiopharmaceutical to the patients, and you start seeing referrals, the patients get treated or imaged, and then they go back to where they came from, the oncologist, whether if it's an oncology practice or academic institution. And that has been growing tremendously over the last 3 years. And that's, I see this as a trend going forward, because we need to get closer to where the patients are. That's something that we're seeing, as we all know, and this is not an issue just with radiopharmaceuticals, it's other therapies as well. Patients need to see the oncologist locally. 80% of the patients stay with a local oncologist. For them to go to a large city, metropolitan city, just to get treatment of that sort, it's very burdensome on them and their caregivers. So the idea is trying to get closer to that patient as much as we can.
And there's another kind of federal regulatory body that kind of gets involved here, right? The U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the NRC. I assume they're the ones that kind of are responsible for credentialing or approving the different sites that are handling and storing and disposing of the product. Does that add a significant layer of complexity, or is that an agency that's kind of well established and supporting kind of the nuclear medicine, because it's their mandate is beyond just medicine?
Yeah. So what's funny is when I started the radiopharmaceuticals 10 years ago, I was only familiar with your traditional pharmaceutical regulatory bodies. So that's whether if it's the FDA or CMS or what have you. And that's kind of like, okay, this is known entities that you can work with. But then you start into radiopharmaceuticals, and to your point, there is a lot of other regulatory bodies that we have to contend with. So the NRC is one of them. Also, we interact very closely with DOT, Department of Transportation, because you're transporting radioactive material, so you have to figure out how we can do it as safely as possible. The NRC has different ways that they handle this. So obviously, they have to license the treating site. And then obviously, as a manufacturer, we have to work them very closely to make sure that everyone is licensed properly. So we can't deliver a dose unless that we know for a fact and it's proven, and we have seen the license of that receiving treating site. And there's a lot of complexity with that too, because this is a new area for the NRC. And there are agreement states, non-agreement states. So some of that is also delegated to the states. So you have to contend with the NRC as a federal agency, but also we have to work with the states in some cases on figuring out how we can deliver and have the right infrastructure to make sure that everyone is safe.
And yeah. just kind of carrying the safety concern forward a little bit. Certainly, there's all these different stakeholders that you kind of mentioned, those that are in the supply chain and are handling the product and ultimately receive the product. Is there any concern about exposure after the patient has received their dose, exposure to others that are around them? So their family members, are there situations where they have to, stay inpatient or be isolated or maintain certain distance for a period of time from, let's say, children or pregnant women? I'm just kind of imagining that those might be concerns, and how should patients and their caregivers think about it?
Yes, and that's a very important point. As you start mapping out the treatment and educating the sites and eventually the patient, as treatment sites start taking on radiopharmaceuticals as a modality, they have to map out the patient flow from referrals all the way to treating and discharging the patient. All these treatments so far in the U.S. are outpatient. Outpatient services. So the patient usually gets there, they get prepped, and they receive the therapy, and there is an observation period, and then they're discharged. When they get discharged, they usually share the patient release information, which basically some educational information with the patient. And a lot of times, you also want to go through this information before the therapy. So you start with the patient before the therapy, giving them information on this is what's going to happen, this is what you're going to need to do, this is the arrangement that you need to have. And then obviously the good practices, repeating, obviously sharing information again after the treatment, saying this is what you need to do. And in many cases, the patient leaves with instructions on how to navigate this the first few days post therapy. A lot of these therapies, in many cases, they get secreted in urine. So they post therapy, part of the observation, they wait for the patient, for example, to void urine. So that's part of it gets taken care of. But also, you know, when you leave the patient, in many cases, they're still. So some of the instructions that the patients are given, they can't be in the same bed with their partner for a couple of days. They can't be near a pregnant woman or a child or a pet. So you can't really, unfortunately, you can't be sitting at home and the pet jumps on your lap. There is obviously concerns with that. So there's a lot of things that they have to work with. And this is something that we still, you know, as an industry, we need to build on and educate the public on what does that really mean. We've seen a lot of improvement over the years on how to handle these patient instructions and how the patients handle that. Working with patient advocacy groups is very critical, as you can imagine, and, you know, dealing with that. So whatever disease area, you just have to make sure that, you know, you go to the patient advocacy groups and educate them, providing them with the information. So there will be no room for misinterpretation or misinformation in this case, to make sure that, you know, they help you educate the patient.
That's really interesting, because those are not, I think, considerations that we normally associate with just therapy. And so there's a lot of work that has to be done before anybody is put on treatment, but there's also this long tail end of what do you do on the back end. And so I imagine that's a lot of work that you have to do, as you mentioned, with many different people. So one question I had for you is, you mentioned that you work with stakeholders that normally are not part of the kind of biopharmaceuticals life cycle, like the Department of Transportation. So in terms of supply chain challenges, can you talk a little bit more about some aspects that are really different from what we normally hear about and deal with?
So from a supply chain perspective, there are a few things that a manufacturer have to contend with. One, securing the actual isotope. So this is something that needs to be sourced properly with appropriate supply, and making sure that there is plenty of it, potentially even making sure that there are a couple of options, a couple of sources, to make sure that it does not impact the flow of the manufacturing. So the supply chain starts with the sourcing isotope, and then obviously the manufacturing process needs to be, as I mentioned earlier, it's on demand, just in time. So you have to really work backwards from when the patient needs to be treated, and then define when the doses need to be manufactured and calibrated properly for the treatment day. It's almost, you know, you have to also think of the treatment hour, because this is, decays very rapidly in some cases. So you have to make sure that you're working backwards. So the manufacturing process, it needs to be on a very tight schedule. And then once the doses are ready, they have to be picked up by a logistics company almost as it's ready, because you can't really make it and put it in a loading dock and just wait for someone to pick it up. So everything has to be planned properly. Obviously, then it make its way, its journey to the treatment site. And the journey to the treatment site in many cases can be very long. So for example, if you manufacture the dose on the East Coast and shipping it to the West Coast, that's a very long journey. And, you know, some of the innovations that you start seeing nowadays is using a tracker and seeing where the doses are at all points of the journey, and trying to automate the process, trying to make sure that the packaging and the transportation is all lined up, and using some advanced logistics and techniques to optimize the routes and seeing how it's going to get to the patient the fastest way possible. And then you have the last mile delivery. So in many cases, what's so funny about nuclear medicine is it's not a very well trafficked area in the hospital that is, you know, lend itself for an easy drop off. So you have to have people who are really understands where nuclear medicine is located within a hospital, to make sure that the dose is dropped off and handed off with the proper chain of custody. That's another area that also it can lead to hiccups. So all these things have to be lined up from a supply chain and logistics. Again, it's an evolving industry. As also you start seeing more doses being delivered, then the challenges end up being compounded because you have more doses trying to get to multiple places across the country. So it's not just point A to point B, it's just point A to a lot of points across the country.
You'd mentioned earlier that we're kind of in the, let's say, the 1.0 phase of radiopharmaceuticals. What is next? Where are the next key opportunities as we look towards the horizon, 1, 3, or 5 years out? And beyond just kind of trying to move the point of care closer to where the patients are, I think you made a good point earlier that can be a burden if they have to travel to a major academic center in an urban area. But beyond that, like in terms of application, what are you excited about and what should we look forward to?
So there's so much to be excited about. The targets, I think there are so many things that we can target. Yeah, in terms of, and provide patient value or patient benefit. So some of the things are being studied right now: CA9, CA12, FAPI, and there are a lot of other targets that's being studied as well. And then on the isotope side, we touched on very briefly the different isotopes has different applications, and that's very exciting because then you start thinking about what is the appropriate isotope at what time and what is the sequence. Can you combine different isotopes so you can get the best of both profiles? So there's a lot of things that can be studied there and can potentially provide value to the patient. I would love to see over the next 5 years the evolution of radiopharmaceuticals and theranostics as part of the treatment paradigm and start seeing it moved in earlier to provide the benefit to the right patient at the right time. And all of this, I think, we're going to start seeing a lot of more data. Also, the other thing that I think we all contend with in the whole biotech, radiopharmaceutical space is combination therapy. So, we start seeing a lot of interest in combining immunotherapy with radiopharmaceuticals where you target the tumor in different ways. There's a lot of things that can be added benefit to the patient by combining different modalities. The challenge with that, very briefly, is then you're adding costs to the healthcare system. So how do you contend with that? And how do you make it easy for the patients to receive different treatment options in a very short period of time? Now, typically, a radiopharmaceuticals, it goes into cycles. So you have 4 or 6 doses over a period of time, and you have to figure out the flow of patient to make sure that they don't miss a dose or, if there's a delay, figure out how to handle that. So that's also very exciting to figure out what is the time horizon, how can we work with the patients to make sure that we provide them the best possible benefit to treat their cancer.
And outside of oncology, do you see any other applications where radiopharmaceuticals are a natural fit now or maybe in the near future?
I think there are applications outside of oncology. I think there has been some studies in different areas. It all depends on finding the right target that would be appropriate for having the ligand or the peptide targeting. Eventually, we'll start seeing it more in other space. I think that's yet to be determined. Also, some of it is defined by how you design the clinical trial. Typically in oncology, clinical trial, you start with the sickest patient, the last line, and then you start making your way up. I think there's going to, in other areas outside of oncology, it's going to be a little tricky because you have to figure out where it fits in that treatment paradigm, and we still need to learn a lot more about the physiology and the physics and the biology to figure out how to address this earlier.
I'm curious to understand who are the big kind of investors or innovators in this space. So here's what I mean: is it your typical big oncology pharma companies like AstraZeneca or Lilly or Pfizer, or is the model different enough that we have other emerging companies that really are the experts in this space and they're going to own that space or be acquired by one of the big pharmaceutical companies.
So up until 2018, there hasn't been a lot of money flowing from big pharma outside of maybe Bayer. They had Radium 225, and that was relatively successful, but it didn't make it into mainstream, if you will. And it wasn't until Lutathera and Pluvicto came to market, and then advanced accelerator application AAA was acquired by Novartis, and that was kind of I think everyone in the community started seeing this as a emerging area. Right now, you have basically two camps, which is not surprising. You have some of the big pharmas trying to get into the space. They see the benefit as an emerging area. So you have, obviously, Novartis is the leader. And you have BMS, AZ, Sanofi. They're starting to make a play. Lilly, of course. So you start having these companies adding the critical mass of investment. And then you have a lot of biotechs in a space that's still trying to get a lot of the products through the pipeline. But eventually, there's going to be, I see, potential consolidation in the market on the smaller side, on the smaller companies. But then that's going to be also a great opportunity for big pharma to acquire new assets and making sure that, you know, they have a robust pipeline. And we'll start seeing that as well. There are a lot of companies, smaller companies, that become the engine of innovation, and that drives the opportunities to big pharma, you know, to acquire this. And, you know, I think that's going to be something that is evolving over time. And we haven't touched at all on the commercialization of these therapies. It's kind of implied in some of the things I've mentioned, but it's a very complex area to commercialize, because you have to go and educate the oncologists, nuclear medicine physicians, and the treating sites, and then obviously the patients. There is a lot of the stuff there that needs to be unpacked and making sure that it's done well. You know, there needs to be an excellence in execution to make sure that nothing falls through the cracks. And you know, these patients, they get treated 3, 4, 5, 6 doses, and missing a dose is not an option, or, you know, you have to work very closely. So the commercialization is very, it's very complex. And, you know, we'll start seeing some companies having the success in commercializing these assets, but also we're also seeing some anecdotal evidence of where the challenges are, and how do you, you know, really learn from your mistakes, and not just as you continue bringing products to market.
Roger, who are the people who work in this field? What kind of background do people have? It's a nascent area. There are probably not that many experts besides you. But who are the people that are, you know, working in Rite Pharmaceuticals right now?
So you have different backgrounds. And when I first started in this space and I was trying to build my team, I was looking for unicorns. You know, it's really hard to find someone with an oncology background and understands nuclear medicine. There are very few. And it took a while to build a strong team that can deliver both. So from a commercial team or even like an overall team, you start looking at folks who are strong in one area, and they have the learning agility to translate in other areas. So there are a lot of very smart nuclear medicine professionals by background, whether if they come from a technologist background, nuclear medicine technologist, and they learn the oncology side of the house, or there are a lot of oncology experienced professionals who find this space very intriguing and complex enough that keeps them on their toes. So building that profile, I think it's a unique, very challenging, but it requires certain type of mindset, understanding that this is not your typical product to commercialize or develop. Even from a clinical development perspective, you have to think of a lot of different things, not just your typical development. There's a lot of, you know, how do you secure the isotope? How do you make sure that the trial is designed properly? So it does require searching for the right talents. And luckily, that pool is getting bigger. So you start seeing a lot more interest and people are starting to see this as an emerging area. People gravitate toward that. emerging area, and they build out their experience. So I can tell you, you know, the evolution from 2018 to now, there's a lot more talents now than it was back in 2018. But I was lucky to build a really good team back then that had the learning agility to go and perform very well.
And Ed, you mentioned, you know, a few of the challenges that might be unique to the space. So, you know, it's kind of the talent identification piece. It sounds like that's improving. We talked about, you know, supply chain complexities. We've talked about kind of the educational requirements in terms of educating providers and the technicians and the patients. So there's a lot there. What are some of the other challenges that you see that you know, are kind of on your mind, right? What keeps you awake at night as we kind of look forward? Because certainly there's a lot of opportunity, but it's a very complex space to operate in successfully.
Maintaining that visibility into the value chain is very important. Making sure that you have visibility from the isotope manufacturing and understand how that works and how are you going to source the isotope all the way through development, making sure that the clinical trial are designed properly to get to a conclusion and make sure that that's appropriately designed and executed. The execution of the clinical trial is very critical. And that, in my mind, that is the first step to making it successful in radiopharmaceutical, is making sure the clinical trial is well designed and also executed. From a commercial perspective, I emphasize a lot the nature of the interactions with the different stakeholders. You have the clinical side, you have the non-clinical side, and you have to make sure that they go hand in hand. You have to educate the physicians on what the clinical data and the benefit of the product, and making sure that they understand the right patient at the right time, what that looks like. But then you have to think about what are the non-clinical barriers and addressing that ahead of time. So you work very closely with the treatment sites to iron that out beforehand, and it's not a one-time deal. You have to work through that and become a partner with the treatment site to make sure that this is, this is an ongoing relationship. So the clinical, non-clinical aspect of the commercialization is very critical. And I've seen instances where a treatment site, you know, became too proud to ask for help on a non-clinical side, and that impacted their adoption, impacted their, you know, the how to deliver value to their patients. And then eventually we had to go back and help them fix that. So there's a lot of things that I think in my mind that's very important, and it needs to be addressed ahead of time.
One last question for me, Roger, is you mentioned imaging as an important aspect, because obviously you're talking about both therapeutics and diagnostics. And then we also have, you know, we just talked about things like AI, machine learning, big data. Is there one technological advancement or trend that you're particularly excited about because you think it could be applied to your area? So for instance, you were talking about how complex it is just to enroll patients in trials. And there's potential for automating certain aspects of that. But is there something that sticks out to you as this is really going to move the needle for us?
So there are a lot of cool things happening right now in the area. So from an imaging perspective, you have really innovative cameras that's being developed and rolled out in the market, where they can get a really fantastic image within 15, 20 minutes, which is, when you think about the standard, which is 45 minutes to an hour, 15 minutes, it's very, very quick. And it also helps the patients. You know, we've all been there where, you know, you have to get imaged somehow for a reason, whether it's an MRI and what have you. And the first thing they tell you, you know, if you're claustrophobic, don't go in. But, you know, having a quick image, 15 minutes, that also can be very helpful for the patient. So it's not just duration, but also the type of information that you get. There is now an expansion of AI and how AI can be leveraged in interpreting images. Obviously, that doesn't remove a radiologist and nuclear medicine physician out of the equation. It just speeds up the process, hopefully, or maybe identify certain things that maybe they need to be double checked. So that's an area that I think is going to have high impact, especially when you start seeing more ready from a circle humming in more prevalent disease. So we now have prostate, and also we have Alzheimer imaging, brain imaging. So you start start stacking up no indications or no products. You start having breast cancer, lung cancer. Then we're talking about millions of images potentially that needs to be processed. So AI can add a quality there. And then that goes hand in hand with the imaging and the uptake and the AI. How do you identify the dose optimization? How do you go about identifying the right dose for the patient? And that's going to be very critical eventually. You know, we kind of started the conversation talking about personalized medicine, and that needs to be done through the right dosimetry. So this dosimetry software that goes hand in hand with AI and the right imaging can eventually develop the very personalized dose that for specific patients based on the uptake, based on a predictable algorithm to figure out what is the right response or the expected response based on all of that. I think all of that, that's we haven't gone there yet, but there's a lot of studies of a lot of people who are very smart in the study in this and trying to bring it to market as fast as possible.
Well, thank you so much for this conversation. I've certainly learned a lot. It wasn't an area that I knew much about at all. So I really appreciate being able to jump into your world a little bit and learn a bit more. One question we like to leave with all of our guests is to learn a little bit more about you, but more specifically, anything that has kind of inspired you, either personally or professionally, and it could be a person or an event or kind of a motto. We always like to ask that question and leave on a positive.
Sure. I think one of the most inspiring experiences that I've had early on when I started in Ready Pharmaceutical 10 years ago is being at a patient event where they brought patients that spent the time their own money to go to Europe to get that therapy that we were trying to approve in the U.S. And they were talking about how much of an impact that made on them and their families. And to me, that was an eye-opening, not just on the patient impact or the patient benefit, but also opened my eyes to the fact that there's a lot of work for us to do in the U.S. to bring nuclear medicine to a standard that's commensurate to what's already going on in Europe and Australia. They're ahead of us in some of the studies, some of the applications, but I think we have an opportunity to bring that to the patients here in the US. And to me, that was an experience that I still take with me. And some of these patients became friends over the years, and to see them thriving and their families thriving because they received the therapies on time at the right time, and it made an impact on them. To me, that was, I still keep that in the back of my mind when I work in the space.
Well said. Thank you so much for sharing that.
Yeah, wonderful to hear.
Roger, this was a fascinating episode and discussion. I learned so much. This is a totally new field to me, and you did an amazing job just educating us newbies, and thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Roger.
I always like when we have a guest who can really educate us about something that we don't know much about. And Roger did that certainly for me, for radiopharmaceuticals. It was a really kind of nebulous field, and there were so many interesting aspects to it that he explained in great detail, very patiently. I really enjoyed this episode, Ian.
Yeah, I did too. I think for a lot of the same reasons. It's such a divergent area of study. And kind of the MOA, certainly from what we're used to in the traditional pharma drug world, and all the complexities that go along with it. I mean, things that you and I haven't had to think about at all in our career are extremely important, as we talked about in terms of supply chain and safety and kind of this just-in-time inventory management and all the things that kind of surround that. Really fascinating, but also really exciting, because I think this opens up relatively new treatment options for these patients that hopefully can deliver results that otherwise they wouldn't have available to them. And of course, you love to hear those stories. It's a lot of fun when you see technology moving forward in such a significant way. So thank you to Roger for helping us.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. It's really the aspect of how does this make patients' lives better? How can we deliver much more targeted therapy? And then also this combination of diagnostics and therapeutics, two in one, I thought was so unique. And I really want to see how this plays out more.
Yeah, totally agree. All right. Another fun episode, Nari. Thank you.
Thank you, Ian.
And that's a wrap on today's episode of Real Pharma. We hope our dose of pharmaceutical discourse has left you in good spirits and has increased your titers of knowledge.
Absolutely. If you found today's pill-packed adventure as stimulating as a shot of epinephrine, we'd love for you to show us some brand loyalty.
Yes, drop us a like and leave a review. It's the best prescription for podcast success.
Think of your review as the little booster shot that keeps our show in tip-top shape.
And hey, don't just keep us as your secret remedy. Share the good vibes and let others in on our Real Pharma therapeutic sessions.
So hit that review button like it's the perfect cure for a long commute. Your feedback is the treatment that keeps us going.
Thanks for tuning in. And remember, an episode a day keeps the boredom away.
Stay curious, stay healthy, and keep this podcast prescription handy for biopharma stories and insights.
See you next time.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. Please visit us at realpharma.co for more valuable resources. Real Pharma is brought to you by Black Canyon Ventures.